Well, hello everyone. Thanks all for joining us. We really appreciate your interest and your taking the time to discuss our research. I want to briefly go over our plan for the call. Because of the number of people on the call, GiveWell staff will primarily be the ones talking. If you have any questions, please email them to info@givewell.org. That's info@givewell.org with the subject line conference call question, and we'll read them and answer them on the call. We'll aim to answer all the questions, but we're going to try to group them topically rather than answer them chronologically. We have noted the questions people send in advance of the call, and we're going to address those as well. At the moment, all your lines are muted, but if we do have time at the end of the call and if there's interest, we'll open the call up for more discussion. To let us know that you'd like to speak, you can just hit *6 on your phone and then follow the instructions. Doing so is going to alert me that I should unmute your line. When I do so, you'll be alerted that your line is unmuted, and you can then ask your question and remain unmuted for the discussion. We're going to initially break this call into two parts. First, I'm going to describe our process for finding charities and then quickly review strengths and weaknesses for our three top-rated organizations. If you're looking for information beyond what I present, there's plenty on our website. Then after the presentation, we'll answer questions for a while before coming to topic number two, which is our plans for future research. We're tentatively planning for this call to run about an hour, but we're happy to stay on longer if there's interest. We are recording this call so that we can post it on our website, so feel free to leave at any time. You'll have a chance to finish listening later. Before getting started, I just wanted to introduce the GiveWell staff who you may hear talking on the line so you know our voices. I'm Ellie Hassenfeld, a GiveWell co-founder.
I'm Holden Karnowski, the other GiveWell co-founder.
And I'm Alexander Berger, a GiveWell research analyst.
Great. So first up is going to be the research process that we followed this year. In past years, we had conducted a broad scan of hundreds of charities. We did not repeat this scan in 2012. Instead, we focused our efforts on, first, continuing to track and follow up our top-rated charities from last year. Second, we continued to analyze additional organizations that we had found promising but were not top-rated at the end of 2011. And then third, we looked for opportunities to fund additional proven, cost-effective, scalable programs. In particular this year, we looked into immunization and self-iodization programs. We've written more about them, but in brief, in both cases, it often initially looked as if there were going to be opportunities to fund them. But once we looked into the opportunities more closely, it appeared that someone already had or was about to provide funding. We're happy to get into more discussion of that if there's interest. But going through this whole process left us with three top charities, the Against Malaria Foundation, or AMF, and the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, or SCI, which were both our two top-rated charities last year. We've also added a new top charity, GiveDirectly, which provides direct cash transfers to very poor people in the developing world. Now I'm just going to briefly give some basic facts, strengths, and weaknesses about each organization. Our number one ranked organization is AMF, which distributes BedNet to prevent malaria. BedNet distribution has the strongest evidence of any charitable program we've seen outside of perhaps immunizations. We know, as much as such things are knowable, that BedNets prevent malaria and save lives, and at $5 each, they're incredibly cheap. AMF is an outstanding organization. Its CEO is constantly pushing to run the best distributions he can, and he's collecting data that could influence the global malaria community to improve. There's a giant global funding gap for nets. Even though they're cheap, there are close to a billion people who need nets, and nets wear out after a couple of years, so they need to be replaced. All these factors combine to make AMF a really great giving opportunity. GiveDirectly, our number two charity, runs arguably one of the simplest programs. It just grants out 90 cents on every dollar it receives directly to extremely poor individuals, and it argues that they're the ones most likely to know how best to help themselves. Now, a lot of developing world country governments have run cash distribution programs, but GiveDirectly is the first charitable organization we found that's just taking in money and giving it out in the developing world. Their government-run programs have been successful. They find significant increases in spending on basic needs like food and no evidence of significantly more spending on items like alcohol or cigarettes. There are some studies that follow up with recipients years later and find significant returns, roughly 20% on the capital granted. Like AMF, we think the people behind GiveDirectly are sharp and talented, and there's a lot of upside to their building GiveDirectly in terms of how it could change the world of international aid to be more driven by what people need rather than what programs outside charities think are the best ways to improve people's lives. With GiveDirectly, a lot of the judgment among donors may come down to one's intuition about how likely empowering people to directly buy the things they most need is to be among the best charitable interventions. Our number three ranked organization is SDI, which does deworming. This is a health intervention, but it's very different from bed nets, which prevent malaria. In the case of deworming, we know based on numerous clinical trials that the pills SDI deliver kill the parasites that are infecting the individuals. And we also know that distributing these pills is incredibly cheap at around 50 cents a person. But there's a great deal of uncertainty about the difference this makes to someone's life. We know that you won't die if you're infected, so being dewormed doesn't save your life. And even for subtler health effects like nutritional status, there have been a lot of studies, and it's still not clear if there are significant effects. But there are a couple of studies that we've vetted and find credible that find enormous long-term impacts to deworming. In one, they randomly assigned some children to get dewormed, some not to. They followed up with the dewormed children years later and found that they were earning about 25% more than their counterparts who weren't dewormed. Now, there are some tough questions to answer around how credible and representative this study is, but basically, if you believe those results, deworming is arguably the best charitable intervention. And if you don't, well, it may not be accomplishing very much. While SDI has a strong track record of successfully implementing deworming programs, we don't have quite as much confidence in it as we do AMF, and we don't see the same upside opportunities for it to achieve more than its core mission of deworming children. But, you know, we still see it as an outstanding giving opportunity because it's an organization with a strong track record doing a very cheap health intervention that could have huge and lasting benefits. So with that, I think it's time to move over to Q&A. So just as a reminder, if you have questions for the time being, please just email them to info@givewell.org, info@givewell.org, with the subject line, conference call question, and then we'll read them and answer them on the call. To get things started, I think we wanted to address some of the questions that we've seen raised about cash transfers and GiveDirectly in particular. So Holden, did you want to address those questions?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So there's been a lot of concerns raised over our recommendation of a cash transfer organization. And I think a lot of it is just, you know, people have definitely very differing intuitions on this particular thing. So, you know, some people think that that it's really unlikely that the cash transfers are spent well, and others think that that people are likely to make the best decisions for themselves. And, you know, I think there is strong evidence that cash transfers increase consumption, but we do feel that a lot of how one feels about GiveDirectly is going to come down to where one starts off on these intuitions. So there's a lot of angles we can cover on this point, and we expect a lot of questions on this. But the questions I'm going to start with were the ones we were asked to address on this call, which are the questions raised in a post on the Giving What We Can blog.
This conference is being recorded.
There were questions that were specifically about, you know, the evidence for cash transfers and the cost effectiveness. So there are a lot of studies of cash transfers, and they generally show encouraging results. They show increased consumption. They especially show increased consumption on food. And then there's, you know, basically a couple of studies that show more long-term effects, show that people are still benefiting from them years after getting the cash transfers, and kind of implying very impressive rates of return. And so some of the questions that have been raised are around the quality of this evidence. And just as an example of one objection that's been raised, you know, when we say that cash transfers increase consumption, both in the short term and in the long term, there's been kind of this observation that, well, they increase consumption according to self-reported data. In other words, you know, in these studies, they're asking people how much they spent, and that's the basis on which they're concluding the cash transfers increase consumption. And so we've seen concern that that these studies are not reliable because of that. And the main thing I want to observe here is that using self-reported data on consumption or on earnings is really not unusual in academia. It depends a lot on how it's done. And so if you give an intervention and then you ask people, did this intervention help you? That's one kind of self-reported data that we think is very unreliable because the people you're asking will generally be able to hear what kind of answer you're looking for, and they'll give you the answer they think you want to hear, or at least it's a strong risk. But there's a different kind of self-reported data that I think is much more reliable, which is, for example, you randomize who gets the cash and who doesn't, and then a long time later, you follow up with a very long survey that's asking them all sorts of questions about their lives, and some of those questions are, how much did you spend last month or last year over some time period? And then you go and you compare the control group, the people who didn't get the cash, to the treatment group, the people who did get the cash, and you look for differences in those numbers of the averages people reported. So this becomes a much, you know, you can see how kind of intuitively it's there's a lot of more obstacles to someone who's trying to tell the surveyor what they want to hear. I mean, they don't know what the control group's going to be saying. It's a long survey. It's a very specific question. It doesn't have the most obvious connection to the intervention. And this is, you know, generally how the stronger academic studies are done. Now, this is not just about cash transfers. Actually, the best evidence for deworming we're aware of is using the same basic setup. It's, you know, the kind of the headline figure in our view, the figure that really makes deworming compelling, is this kind of higher reported earnings for people who got dewormed in childhood. But those are reported earnings. That's also done using the same survey data collection process as far as we know. Likewise with bed nets, there's this kind of question, you know, so some of the results with bed nets are not self-reported, right? Like they're, you can look at kind of clinical records of what happened to malaria. But there is one of the lingering questions with bed nets is whether people use their bed nets in practice as opposed to just in the studies. And there again, you've got self-reported data on whether people use bed nets relative to whether they own them. So there's a couple things to say here. One is we do think the self-reported data is not bad. We think it's pretty reliable. It's collected in a pretty good way that's likely to lead to good results. But the other observation is that it is fairly common to collect data this way. And so if someone is looking at this evidence and saying, boy, this is not as ironclad as I thought it was, well, that pretty much applies to most evidence about the long-term impacts of charitable interventions on people's lives. And so we at GiveWell, I think we've, for a long time, we've kind of seen a lot of the holes in this evidence and seen it as not so ironclad. And I think that does have something to do with our positive attitude on Give Directly and cash transfers. Because in my view, kind of the more skeptical you are of the approach of, you know, sort of collecting data in this way and analyzing it and putting it all together to decide what's best, the more you're going to recur to simpler interventions, to interventions with a more intuitive case like cash transfers, and we don't go all the way. We do think the evidence is meaningful. We don't have cash transfers ranked as the best intervention, but it is worth keeping in mind that, you know, none of these evidence bases are totally ironclad, and the differences between the cash evidence and deworming evidence, I mean, we think they're pretty much in the same league. So I didn't address all the issues that have been raised with the evidence of cash, and we're going to write more about them, but broadly speaking, we think it's kind of comparable. Then there's this question of, okay, so let's assume that cash transfers are helping people, but there's this question of how much they're helping people, and how does that compare to a bed net or to deworming? And this is another area where I think intuitions are going to diverge a lot and people are going to come to really different conclusions because it is a bit apples and oranges, and it's a very hard to find kind of reliable comparisons, and it's also very hard to estimate how much good is accomplished by these interventions. And so, you know, with bed nets, you're saving the lives of children under 5. You're also reducing cases of malaria. With deworming, you're not saving any lives, but you may be kind of, you know, certainly we don't have strong evidence that you're saving substantial lives, but you may be helping people to earn more later in life, which averting malaria may do too. And then with cash, a lot of times you just don't know the exact nature of the benefit that you're giving, and so it can be hard to estimate and hard to compare. We're going to be writing about the cost effectiveness of these three things, and basically, we've tried to compare them a bunch of different ways. And so we've looked at kind of simple measures that leave a lot to the imagination, like the cost per year of being covered by a bed net versus the cost per year of being covered by a metal roof, which is how a lot of people spend the cash. We've also tried to do sort of estimates that take a lot more analysis and work and guesstimating on our part, and that leave with something a little bit more satisfying, like the cost per life saved equivalent. One of the comparisons we've done for trying to compare cash to other things is we've looked at, you know, deworming helps people earn more money later in life. I mean, that to us is the most compelling reason to support deworming. Is it better to instead just give them the money and let them invest it, or is it better to pay for the deworming? Which one results in more money later in life relative to how much money you spent in the first place? And when we do that analysis, I do think deworming comes out looking better, and we do think that in a vacuum, deworming is a better, is probably accomplishing more good per dollar than cash, and bed nets are probably accomplishing more good per dollar than deworming. But these are pretty uncertain, and you can sort of argue it either way. There are reasonable scenarios under which cash is the best, and so we don't think it's such a blowout that it just resolves the situation. And when we factor in kind of the organizational factors, the fact that we are more confident in Give Directly as an organization, the fact that we do see more potential for innovation and for kind of, you know, larger scale impact, that's why we have Give Directly as number two and SCI as number three. And then the final point I want to make just on this initial discussion of some of the points people have raised about cash, you know, we do not fully embrace the argument that just because cash gives people choice that it's better. We see a lot of reasons that that is not enough. So we've written about these in the past. Alexander actually wrote a post back in May listing quite a few reasons, and not just poor rationality, why it might be better to kind of decide on people's behalf how to help them. One of those cases is sort of externalities. So bed nets, they don't only protect the person under the bed net, they protect other people because they're killing mosquitoes. And so it's, you know, it's kind of an externalities market failure argument. There's also more obvious arguments like people in the developing world may not have the education or the information to spend the money as well as we could on their behalf. So we think there's definitely arguments both ways. But the argument that people can decide for themselves, I think, is an argument, is a powerful argument that bears consideration. And when we kind of look at all the factors, it looks to us like cash is really one of the more promising interventions out there in the grand scheme of things. One of the more promising interventions that there's room for a donor to expand. We don't think in a vacuum that it's as good as deworming or as bed nets, but when we look at organizational factors, that's why we come out with Give Directly at number two.
All right, so we've had a few questions come in, and so we're going to go through those. We're also happy to return to the discussion of Give Directly and CATH or other top charities as we move through the call. So we had a question come in about Partners in Health, which is an organization that GiveWell had as a number two ranked organization back when we initially started it, and has long been one that you know, a lot of donors ask us about. So I guess we're just going to. So someone's question was, what, you know, what's our current take on Partners in Health?
And, yeah, I'm going to take this one. This is Alexander again. So we visited one of Partners in Health, local hospitals in Malawi during our site visits last year. And we've spent a long time talking to Partners in Health staff members over the years. I'd say, like, we continue to have a positive impression of them as an organization. But our big question has been this issue we call room for more funding, which is how does a marginal dollar to Partners in Health get spent? A lot of the story that they tell about their impact is that they're really causing changes at the sort of international level through some of their advocacy work and sort of proving it, being used as a sort of proof of concept or an example of how really high quality healthcare can be done in extraordinarily low income settings. And so the thing that, you know, that's pretty different from just sort of scaling up bed nets or something that's like very linear and straightforward and simple. And so it's not something that we've necessarily always felt it's not the kind of thing that we're necessarily super confident in our ability to assess. But separately from that, I'd just add that, you know, a lot of the things that they seem to want to spend more money on aren't necessarily things that are closely tied in with sort of more advocacy. And so it seems like the case for their impact has been advocacy oriented, but a lot more money might sort of go into providing more advanced healthcare in the settings where they work, and that seems less cost-effective to us, ballpark, than the kinds of health interventions that we're currently recommending.
There's one other thing I would just add about partners in health, which is that, I think sometimes organizations run programs that are difficult to monitor, and certainly there's types of impacts that partners in health could be having that are going to be tough to quantify. You know, nonetheless, I think it's reasonable to expect organizations to, or at least for the organizations that you know, I'd be really excited about giving to expect them to be generating, sharing the data that helps to support a compelling argument that they're having the types of impacts they hope. And, you know, that's something that, you know, I feel like we have yet to see that type of information from partners in health. So in addition to the cost effectiveness concerns, you know, that's still something that, you know, I feel like I haven't seen but would be interested in seeing from them. All right. Well, we had another question come in, which related to STI and deworming, and this question was whether there's any further evidence that, you know, we expect to come forward about the impacts of deworming or STI that could cause it to rise or fall off your list. So I'll just quickly jump in, and then, you know, maybe my colleagues will want to answer as well. You know, one of the things I think could make a big difference to our view of deworming would be additional data from randomized controlled trials that help to better ground the effect that is found in the single RCT that we know of. You know, unfortunately, as far as we know, there's no other RCT going on right now. And it would, you know, were one to be funded today, it would obviously take a great deal of time until the long-term earnings data was in. I think given the current state of interest in funding deworming, there's some question about whether that, you know, that type of research would even be valuable. But it does, you know, add to the, you know, kind of the overall picture of deworming that it's the case that, you know, a single additional RCT could really make a huge difference. You know, if it found no result or it found a significant result in trying to, you know, form a reasonable estimate of the likely impact of a deworming program. You know, on the SCI front, you know, as we are recommending additional funding to SCI this year, we're going to continue following them. You know, we hope to continue to gain a better understanding about their activities and how they use funds. We have been following SCI reasonably closely since the middle of, you know, early to mid 2009. And so I'm not, you know, I wouldn't say that I think it's extremely likely that our work on SCI yields a significantly different understanding of its activities than we have in the past. But certainly, you know, it's possible. And if I had to guess about the most likely place for our view to adjust in the coming year, it would come from, you know, improving our understanding of how SCI has and is likely to spend additional funds. Holden or Alexander, anything you wanted to add to that?
No.
Okay. All right. Another question we had come in was about our cost effectiveness estimates for bed net distribution. So the question was, what drove the increase in the cost per life saved for ANF from $1,600 per life, which is what our estimate was earlier this year, to $2,300 per life, which is what we're saying now. And then also, was there any progress in measuring other benefits of malaria prevention beyond infant mortality reduction? Holden, do you want to take that one?
Yeah. So on the first question, why did our estimate of the cost per life saved for AMF go up? So we wrote a post about this, and I think it was called something like Revisiting the Case for Bed Nets. And basically, you know, we had a GiveWell staff member go through and do a thorough kind of audit of our research on bed nets. And one of the issues that I think we went through a lot of rounds of back and forth on this, and we found a lot of potential issues, and most of them I think we resolved. But one thing that we noticed in the course of doing this is that the kind of the lives saved from bed nets are they're coming not just from malaria deaths, but they're coming from all deaths. And so the kind of studies in the 90s that found that bed nets saved the lives of children under five, what they actually found is something like a 20% reduction in mortality from all causes in children under five. And we think this makes sense because malaria can, you know, can weaken you and can make you more susceptible to other diseases. And we discussed this with malaria experts, and this checks out. But something that seems worth observing is that child mortality has fallen a lot since the time these studies were done. And so we tried to make an adjustment for the fact that it's a different baseline now. There's fewer children dying in the first place. Now, it's possible that the deaths you could have saved with bed nets have now already been saved by other means. And so it's actually, at this point, just from this factor alone, I'd say it's possible that bed nets aren't saving any lives. It's also possible that, you know, now there's children who wouldn't have had a chance before, but now if you protect them from malaria, they'll live, and so it's possible that bed nets are saving more lives. But, you know, to us, the kind of middle ground was to look at the fact that childhood mortality had declined and know that you're going to be working from a lower baseline when you're trying to save lives. And so when we did our best to adjust for that, that's how we got to the higher number, and that is going to be in our write-up on bed nets, and that's also in our blog post. On the other question, the non-mortality benefits of bed nets. So there's basically one study that is very similar to one of the studies done on deworming. It is not an experiment. It's kind of a very detailed examination of historical data, and it claims that kind of the benefits of reducing malaria are real and lead to higher incomes down the line, much as with deworming. It was not really something where you could directly compare the impacts to deworming, because we're talking about like different countries, different settings, and it's hard to adjust and figure out how the malaria control they were discussing compares to bed nets. But, you know, broadly, there's a couple reasons to think that bed nets have major benefits other than saving lives. That study is one of them, which I don't think would be very strong evidence by itself. The other case would be the kind of just fact that bed nets are found to have a lot of short-term health impacts. And, you know, they have impacts on measures of nutrition, measures of anemia. And furthermore, bed nets are having these effects in children under five, which there's other evidence from other domains that, you know, health improvements before the age of five quite plausibly pay off later in life and can lead to real differences later in life. And so it's a pretty intuitive case. It's a pretty rough case. And yet I think it's a pretty strong case. I actually, to me, if I were betting, I would probably be more confident that bed nets have impacts later in life than I would about deworming because of this under five issue that kind of the under five health is there's more instances of that making a difference later in life. And so I think there is good reason to think there's benefits. As a shorthand, when we've done our cost effectiveness analysis, we've assumed those benefits to be similar to those for deworming. That doesn't make a huge difference in the analysis the way that we've done it. If you place a lot more weight on those benefits and those become what's really important to you, then you have to ask yourself how plausible you find that case and how much you believe that. So that's kind of where we stand on the non-mortality benefits of bed nets. And no, there wasn't really any new information on that front this year. I mean, I think something that's important to know is that if you're looking for long-term impacts on people's lives, these are just really expensive and really difficult to measure. You have to follow people in the developing world for a long time. It takes a long time to get this information. It takes a lot of money, and any little thing going wrong can make the study a lot less easy to trust. So if you're looking for long-term impacts, you kind of have to work with the kind of evidence we've been discussing.
And then, you know, there are a couple other things with bed nets that we haven't investigated because we, you know, given that we're currently seeing AMS and bed nets as our top-ranked organization and the most promising opportunity to give to, you know, we haven't investigated fully. And so, you know, there are things. So other diseases are transmitted by mosquitoes. One example is lymphatic filariasis, another neglected tropical disease. In many places, it's controlled using drugs in a way similar to what STI does for deworming. In some places, that's not possible because of certain diseases that I believe the treatment that would be given out for lymphatic filariasis would have adverse effects if they came into contact with this other disease. And so they just control lymphatic filariasis with NETs. You know, we haven't tried to incorporate that type of estimate into our cost effectiveness estimate. Similarly, we've written about this very briefly on the blog. You know, we haven't considered the mortality effects of bed nets on adults. And that's something that, you know, the most robust long-term data doesn't show that there is a very great problem of adult mortality from malaria in the developing world. Nonetheless, there have been some estimates, in particular one that came out either late last year or early this year, which argued for a much larger burden of adult mortality to malaria. And if, you know, those numbers were true, you'd, you know, consider the estimate that we have for AMS cost effectiveness as being, you know, significantly underestimating its cost effectiveness. So that's sort of about the cost effectiveness and impact of NETs. We had a question come in that relates to the room for more funding for NETs at large. You know, the big picture with NETs is that even though on an individual basis they're very inexpensive at $5 a person, because of the number of people who need NETs and the fact that they wear out, the data about how long NETs last is not particularly reliable, but the best estimates are that NETs last between 2 and 4 years, so they need to be replaced pretty often. You know, this means that the global net gap is quite large. You know, I think it's on the order still of, you know, $500 million to $1 billion of funding that is needed just to buy the nets and get them out. One of the things we've done a lot of this year is spoken to many people who play different roles in the malaria control community. And, you know, one of the things that came across in those conversations, and, you know, these conversations are posted on our website on the conversations page, but it's just the fact that, you know, the need for funding to buy commodities is a very real one in malaria control, meaning that there just isn't enough funding to buy nets, and more money would buy more nets. And that the response that we got from the malaria community was quite different than the response that we got from, you know, for example, the immunizations community. And this is also something we've written a lot about. You know, that's a case where, you know, certainly the commodities, the immunizations are largely paid for, and it seems like the other costs associated with delivering the basic immunizations are also there. You know, so basically, both with AMS specifically and with NETs generally, there appears to be a very large funding gap and one that we're not yet close to closing. Another question that I was hoping to address, and this goes back to an organization that we recommended a couple of years ago, and that organization is Village Reach, which was our top-rated organization from the middle of 2009 till the end of 2011. And, you know, one of the questions was, you know, when we recommended Village Reach, they received a great deal of donations. And then we took them down, and then, you know, obviously the GiveWell source donations have fallen. And what does that mean for the incentives for an organization to participate in our process? You know, does the type of analysis we've done for Village Reach, you know, create incentives or disincentives for charities engaging with us? You know, I think that, you know, overall, I think that it's, you know, what Village Reach has done with us is something they deserve a lot of credit for. Because they've been willing to open themselves up in a way that many other organizations would not have been. And, you know, that wasn't just kind of in the period during which they were receiving funding or were likely to receive funding, but, you know, even after, you know, they were no longer a top-rated organization, they've remained very transparent. And, you know, that is something that we really have appreciated. And, you know, I guess we don't yet know the answer, but I certainly believe that the donors who follow GiveWell and other donors of similar mindset, you know, really, really value that. And you know, so I don't think it's harmful to Village Reach. You know, whether it's ultimately, you know, beneficial and you know, whether we should provide additional funding to Bill and Reach, you know, expressly for the purpose of improving incentives for charities to share information is something that we have thought about, and it's not something that we've, you know, reached a final conclusion on yet. Holden, was there anything you wanted to add to that one?
No.
Sorry, I'm just trying to looking through these questions. So I think maybe it makes sense to kind of move on to discussing some of our future research. You know, Holden, you can do that, and then we're going to, you know, we'll come back and take questions on that. We're also happy to take questions, you know, answer some of the questions that have come in, but we haven't got to yet in this part of the call.
Okay, so to talk about our future research, I mean, first off, a lot of our future research will be in the same vein that we've been talking about. So it'll be looking for, you know, more opportunities to directly translate dollars spent into lives improved, and that includes, you know, looking at the best evidence-backed interventions we see, also some of the more promising interventions that may not be strictly evidence-backed, but that kind of, you know, stuff like clean water is and surgeries are things that we may look at to try and find ever more opportunities for this kind of very direct, simple aid. At the same time, we do think it's very important to branch out and to get into areas of giving that are much higher risk and higher reward. This is something we've stayed away from to date. We think it's harder, we think it takes more context, and we think it can be harder to communicate all the arguments for and against a charity to an individual donor. But we ultimately don't want to leave all that opportunity for impact on the table, and we want to start exploring other areas. Now, we do expect it to take a long time to reach giving recommendations in new areas. And the reason we think this is because it took us several years to feel confident in our giving recommendations in international aid, and looking back, I think it was important that we got a lot of context and a lot of basic understanding and basic information in this cause. And so in the future, you know, I think it's very possible that we won't want to make particular giving recommendations until we've understood the general fields, the general context pretty well. Because it's definitely a common experience of ours that a certain giving opportunity sounds great on the surface, but the more you investigate it, the more it kind of turns out to be something very different from what you originally thought. With that in mind, there's a few things we're doing to explore other areas of philanthropy. One is that we're working with Carry from Good Ventures to try and get to know some of the major foundations, Gates Foundation, Hewlett Foundation, understand what they think the best giving opportunities are, why they think that, and how they think generally. These are organizations that have been doing what they're doing for a long time, and we think there's definitely a lot to learn from them. Another front that we have done some work on this year and will do more work on is what we call strategic cause selection. And the idea here is to pick broad issues in philanthropy that we think are especially promising. So it's very common for a foundation to pick issues like U.S. education or environment. And it's also quite common that the way they pick those issues is kind of by following the personal interests and passions of the person funding. And the thing that we wonder is, if you were kind of looking across all the different issues you might choose and looking for the ones where you're going to have the most impact, could that lead you to a better choice of issue areas than just following your personal interests? And we certainly hope so. So a couple things we've done this year, you know, we've written about what we've read about the history of philanthropy and what's gone well. We've had trouble getting good information about that, but we've written about what we've seen. We've also analyzed where today's philanthropic dollars go. And broadly speaking, we look for issues that seem not to get much attention from philanthropy, much dollars from big philanthropists, relative to how promising they are. And we have a list of causes that kind of fit this criteria, and we're going to be looking into them a little more and writing about what we find. And so that's kind of, you know, having a broad bird's eye view of all the causes and trying to pick especially good ones. And then the third thing that we're doing to explore philanthropy more broadly is picking a couple areas to do more deep investigations of. So, for example, we think it's very important for us to understand the world of funding scientific research, particularly biomedical research, because this is where a lot of the smart philanthropy goes. This is where a lot of philanthropy goes, period. There are certainly arguments that the upside is high enough if you develop a cure for cancer or something like that, that it's worth the giving, even at very low odds of success. And we want to understand more about this field, and that's going to be a major priority for the next year. Another area that we've spent a good amount of time on this year and we'll probably spend a good amount of time on next year is what we call meta-research. And the idea here is that in the process of looking for what works in international aid, we've reviewed a lot of academic evidence. And we've seen...
Q&A session started.
Sorry. Kelly, am I going? Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So a lot of the evidence that we review, we've kind of seen ways in which it doesn't seem optimized to do to help humanity as a whole. And a really simple example is that we'll look at a study and we'll have questions about it, and we won't be able to get the data without kind of emailing the authors, which can be a very long process. And this kind of fact that people generally don't share the data in code from studies and allow others to, you know, to do other analyses and to check what they did was kind of a surprise to us, and it's kind of emblematic that in a lot of academic research, you have researchers following incentives that make sense for them, but those incentives aren't necessarily aligned with what would be the best for humanity as a whole. And so there's this question, could we as a funder find leveraged opportunities to improve the incentives of academics, to kind of change the way things work so that there are different norms, different practices, and that research as a whole is done in ways that are more conducive to creating value for humanity. And so in some ways, you know, the work we're doing on these causes, it's a lot like the work that a lot of new philanthropists do when they're kind of trying to get to know a cause. There's a lot of informal conversations, informal exploration, but obviously a big difference is that we don't see our clients as being kind of one donor. We see our clients as being people like you, as being individual donors, as being anyone who wants to learn from what we're doing. So we have a commitment to transparency, to sharing what we learn as we learn it, and that's really what, you know, what our core mission is that we are trying to find the best giving opportunities, and we're writing about it, and in so doing, we're basically trying to create more of a public conversation about how to give, because these days there's relatively little discussion of how to give, and most of it is kind of superficial and focuses on, you know, why it's important to give generously. And to us, you know, by going through this process of getting to know more and more causes and writing about what we find, we're hoping to stimulate a higher quality conversation around them and put out a lot more information to help people give well, even outside of the causes that we've kind of originally made our name in.
All right. Well, if anyone has questions about the new direction or new causes specifically, please send them in. We still have a few questions, most of which relate to our current top charities, which we can address. There's also a couple questions about GiveWell strategy more broadly, which we'll address. And then, you know, again, we're happy to stick around at the end of the call and try to have more open discussion where if people stick on the line, they can, we can have a more open discussion once the kind of formal Q&A is over. But just to get back to the question, so a question that came in was about GiveWell's current thoughts about providing restricted funding. So restricted funding is, you know, where one goes to an organization and says, please, you know, you can have this money, but you can only spend it on a certain activity, whether it's a particular project or a particular type of program like distributing bed nets or deworming or something else. Historically, GiveWell has always recommended donors provide unrestricted funding. But earlier this year, we wrote that there may be times where, you know, GiveWell would recommend providing restricted funding. So, I think there's two major issues to be thoughtful about with restricted funding. The first one is purely mechanical. When a smaller donor goes to a larger organization and restricts the funding, there's just a question of fungibility. This could happen to a larger donor as well, though I think larger donors have more ability to direct the project that's going to occur. So with smaller donors, you know, if one goes to, let's just to pick on a large charity, UNICEF, and says, here's a $1,000 donation, I want you to spend this on malaria, there's certainly the possibility that that doesn't cause $1,000 more to be spent on malaria activities. UNICEF is just able to reallocate money that unrestricted money it had already spent to malaria, had allocated to malaria, and spend that on something else, and then allocate this $1,000 to malaria. And because of fungibility, the amount ultimately spent on malaria doesn't change. There's this practical question. There's also a kind of a conceptual question about, you know, whether donors should use their have their own priorities and believe that they know better what an organization should be doing than the organization itself. And, you know, I think this is a somewhat difficult question to answer. You know, I think certainly the less familiar one is with an area, the less appropriate it is for, you know, one should be more modest about what one thinks will happen and how confident one is in their own views. But, you know, I think there are certainly cases where, you know, restricted funding makes sense. One case in particular where we've thought a lot about restricted funding is a case where the organization is so large that it's almost as if it encompasses many smaller organizations. So, for example, UNICEF is such a gigantic organization that it's almost as if thinking about restricting funds to malaria versus nutrition is you know, in a sense, like slightly less restrictive than it might seem, because, you know, UNICEF itself may not have a particular set of, you know, high-level priorities, and in some ways may even prefer donors to, you know, go to the area that they're most interested in and fund that area. You know, there's also ways to potentially get around this problem of whether one is, you know, trying to drive priorities or be receptive to an organization's priorities. You know, something that we often try to do in our initial discussions with organizations that run multiple programs or even, let's say, within UNICEF's nutrition program where they have multiple nutrition projects, is first ask what are your priorities? What are the things that you most want to fund before we come in and set down our own, you know, our own ideas about what should be funded. But within, you know, within that framework, you know, given if one is able to answer that question of fungibility, which, you know, I think is hard for small donors, easier for larger donors, and then can be careful about this question of, you know, what, you know, do you have sufficient reason to believe that you have a better sense of the right priorities in the organization? You know, I think there are cases where restricted funding makes sense. And it's certainly something that, you know, we do intend to continue looking into, especially as we try to find more of the interventions that we characterize as proven cost-effective and scalable, meaning those programs that have really strong evidence of effectiveness and appear to be very cost-effective and may have the ability to incorporate more funding to scale them up. You know, many of those may require providing restricted funding, for example, providing funding to UNICEF for some sort of you know, health program. You know, in those cases, it's certainly something that we're going to be considered, because it seems like an opportunity to do a lot of good and learn about, you know, and learn about how to accomplish good in aid.
But the short answer to the question, you know, is that we're looking right now. We're not putting that restriction on ourselves. So we're looking for ways to deliver the most evidence-backed interventions, and whatever that looks like, we're looking for it. And so when we say we're having trouble, you know, finding opportunities to fund immunizations, that includes restricted funding. And so, you know, basically we're open to it, and it hasn't turned into giving opportunities yet.
We had a question about the funding gap for NETS, which is, if it is $1 billion or less, you know, why has it not been filled already, given that it is a small net amount relative to all aid and health spending?
Sure.
You know, it seems like this is low-hanging fruit that should have been picked.
Sure. So I'll take this one. I think one thing that's important to note is that there are other proven interventions. And when we say NETS are the most proven intervention we found that does have a funding gap. And so, you know, there's a lot of money going to immunizations. There's a lot of money going to, you know, a lot of things that are proven. And so that's where some of that aid goes. you know, as for the rest of it, why the gap? I mean, malaria funding has gone up a lot since 2004. It's gone up really rapidly, but it still hasn't reached the point where we can get universal bednet coverage across the board. And I think the question of why that is would be kind of a question about international politics and about how the aid agencies work. And, I don't think that the allocations are always following the same criteria that GiveWell follows.
Okay, we also had a question about,
Sorry, can I add, I actually want to add something on that last question, which just occurred to me, which is also, so I mentioned international aid, and I mentioned kind of the aid bureaucracies and the aid agencies, and those are kind of, you know, to me, the natural funders of something like BedNets, because it's kind of this, you know, it's delivery of something proven, and a lot of people might be wondering why the big foundations don't do it. Like, why wouldn't the Gates Foundation come and close this gap? And I think it's important to note that private foundations often believe that they can accomplish a lot more good with high-risk projects than by filling these sorts of gaps. And I think that's a very common belief among private foundations. It might even be universal, and I'm not sure whether we agree with it, but I think that's part of the reasoning behind us wanting to expand into other causes, is that it's something that bears investigation, and it certainly seems to be a common belief that, you know, that these kind of very direct proven interventions are not actually, you know, the best way for smart money to get the most impact per dollar.
We had a couple of questions about a couple other areas of international health aid. One question about, you know, what's the current status of our looking into antiretroviral therapy, which is the treatment for HIV. The reason that we had deprioritized that in the past was because of cost effectiveness issues, that the cost of those drugs were quite high in annual terms. And what they did was, you know, treat people, not cure them. And for that reason, we deprioritized. AIDS in general is an area that is certainly on our priority list. I'm not exactly sure when we'll get to it, but we've had some initial conversations with some people recently about it as we try to get grounded and think about the right way to look into it further. I'd say at the highest level, it's an area that we looked into briefly a couple of years ago, but we definitely hope to come back to, because it seems like it might be an area with more of the proven cost-effective, scalable global health programs. And then we also had a question about tuberculosis. The question was, it seems like there are many ordinary TB cases. So by ordinary, I think the question means, regular tuberculosis as opposed to drug-resistant tuberculosis. Drug-resistant tuberculosis is harder to treat. It's much more expensive. But the question is that it seems like there are many ordinary cases that could be treated with the normal accepted WHO-recommended program. And these cases are going undiagnosed at the moment. Do we have any interest or leads in that area? So tuberculosis is an area that, we've looked into over the years, and we did continue to look into this year. The complication with tuberculosis is that it's not clear what the right path is to improve tuberculosis care. It doesn't seem like there are gaps in literally providing the drugs that people use for their tuberculosis treatment. One of the approaches that organizations take, and an organization we looked at this year that was along this line, is an organization called TB Reach. TB Reach is a grant maker that seeks to find smaller organizations that are trying to essentially encourage people who may have tuberculosis to get tested, so that they enter into the standard country tuberculosis system, which includes both the public and the private sector. And when we look at TB Reach, I mean, there's two big questions that we have about this activity, neither of which we were able to, to fully, to answer, in a way that gave us confidence. One question is, do the activities that these organizations undertake increase the number of people who enter the normal system of tuberculosis care? And just to explain what I mean by the normal system of tuberculosis care, in many places, tuberculosis drugs are available in the private sector. And so when people become sick with tuberculosis, it's not that they just die because they don't have drugs. Instead, they go to a private pharmacist who may not properly diagnose them. They probably, though we don't really know, don't take the full course of tuberculosis treatment. But, you know, because one's tuberculosis symptoms tend to subside after a relatively short period of taking the drug, the people, at least in the short term, probably stay alive and are, you know, their tuberculosis doesn't kill them. And so, you know, there's this question of, well, then what is the humanitarian impact of, you know, even assuming the organizations are able to bring individuals from the, let's call it the unregistered tuberculosis care system into the registered tuberculosis care system, what is the humanitarian impact of that act? It at least appears to us that there is, you know, limited evidence that it has an effect on directly saving people's lives. It may have an impact on reducing the spread of drug-resistant tuberculosis, because one of the ways in which drug-resistant tuberculosis spreads and expands is through individuals who are infected with regular tuberculosis not taking the full treatment regimen. Now, this is something, again, that we have looked into. We've tried to understand the frequency with which a treatment default, meaning someone who doesn't complete their regimen, turns into a case of drug-resistant tuberculosis. This is something that has proven somewhat difficult to model. There are notes on our website where we've gone through the conversations we've had where we tried to. But the bottom line is we haven't yet been able to arrive at an estimate and an understanding of this cause such that we, you know, feel good about recommending an organization in it. Again, this is an area I could easily imagine us coming back to, especially by talking to more people who are well versed in the field, such that they could convince us that the types of programs these organizations are running are having the impacts that they aim to. But you know, that is not something that we've done yet, and not something that is it's not something that's high in our high on our priority list for next year. All right. Well, another question we had was about the this philosophical question that we've alluded to in some of our blog posts and writing, which is the value of interventions that improve lives versus interventions that save lives. Holden, do you want to address that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something where there's definitely not internal agreement on GiveWell, and our views shift a lot, even person to person. So, you know, personally, I value improving lives much more than saving lives, at least for the lives of children under five. There's definitely wildly diverging opinions on this. One observation that I want to make is that a lot of these philosophical debates aren't necessarily that essential for resolving the question of where you should donate. So to give an example, I mean, if you want to improve lives, I think the case that any of our three top charities improves lives, they each could be defended as the strongest case. So, you know, malaria, I think you've got these short-term health impacts that are tangible and this very suggestive evidence that, you know, like deworming, it may have these longer-term impacts. And I find that pretty credible. And personally, that's the one that I would bet on as being the most convincing case. Deworming, obviously, the case is there for improving lives and not for saving lives. And then cash, there's also, you know, a case that you're kind of, that you're empowering people to get their own returns, make their own decisions. If you really value saving the lives of five-year-olds a lot more than you value improving lives, and that's like really the main outcome you're going for, then I think there's basically no case for any charity that we've written about other than AMF. I mean, the case that EdNet saved lives is very strong, and you know, anything else we've seen with a strong case for actually saving lives, we haven't been able to tie it to an organization and a funding opportunity. So, you know, and we've written about some of this. I think there was a post by Natalie Stone a while ago on how she, you know, this is a different philosophical debate, but this is kind of reducing suffering versus increasing empowerment, and she's more interested in reducing suffering, and I'm more interested in increasing empowerment. But a lot of these debates are not that essential to answering the question of where you should donate. And so it's a matter of what are the organizations we're looking at that are carrying out highly promising interventions in ways that are highly transparent to us and in ways that we're confident in.
So we have one more question that I think is on the topic of kind of the current top charities and other associated interventions. You know, obviously we're happy to keep discussing them if more questions come in. And then there are some other questions that are not right on this topic. But, you know, this question was about the intervention of cash and, you know, what our view is on the, you know, the possible situation that, you know, giving the reason that people don't buy bed nets or buy deworming pills is just lack of information. And if they had the information, people would make different decisions, you know, or if they had the understanding of what the impacts would be. Now, this I think is reasonable. I think it's certainly plausible that, you know, people don't have or are not fully weighing all the benefits of health interventions. You know, frankly, one of the things that I'm most interested in about when I think about here directly is the, you know, the possibilities it offers for future research into these exact questions. So one of the things that I'd really be interested in seeing Give Directly do is, you know, at some point, some arm of its process, not just provide cash, but provide cash plus information. You know, when people are enrolled in the program, you can tell them about bed nets and deworming pills, in addition to telling them about the costs to replace the roof or the benefits to migration. There's all sorts of information that could be shared with recipients of cash. And that offers, you know, some insight into the, you know, the what's actually going through someone's head when they decide how to spend their money. And so, you know, when we talk about Give Directly upside, I mean, this is one of the possible upsides that I see, that there's a possibility that we'll learn more about, you know, these types of questions.
Okay.
So now I guess I just wanted to get on to a couple questions that were not directly related to our top charities, but other questions related to GiveWell. So the question was, GiveWell, the organization, has incentives that will inevitably sometimes be different than its mission. There are malicious ways for GiveWell to be selfish and try to grow itself, and then there are more unconscious biases. How much thinking does GiveWell do about these types of biases and how to avoid being influenced by them? You know, I'll just answer this quickly, and Holden, you can add if you want. I mean, this is something that, you know, we're very aware of. we work hard to try to, you know, to be aware of the ways in which we, you know, we might be biased in the things that we're doing. I think that the research we do is straightforward and is not biased. Nonetheless, I mean, I think the most important way in which we deal with this is just by being totally transparent about what we do and why we do it. For our top charities, you know, what we've looked at and what evidence and argument has led us to the conclusions that we have. And then we have conversations like this where people can ask us questions and, you know, we put this all out in public. And so, you know, while obviously anyone can say our work is not biased, I mean, we just try to put all the information we can out there transparently and, you know, allow everyone to make their own decision about, you know, the credibility of our work.
Yeah, and I think I think it's a real challenge to think about how to make this work of deciding where to give, how to make it more accountable, more reliable, how to take it something beyond what it is today, where it really seems kind of willy-nilly how people decide where to give. And, you know, a lot of the idea of GiveWell and a lot of the innovation we're trying to bring about is this idea of an organization whose kind of our selling point is that we will be able to make good arguments for what we believe, and that we will, you know, that the information we give you will be the best information we have available. So that, I think, that's our brand, and we expect to lose customers, and we expect things to go badly if we fail to deliver on that. And I think that's something that is unique about GiveWell. There are other organizations like foundations deciding how to give, but they're not out there making a commitment that they will explain to the world at large why they're doing what they're doing, and that people who don't think it adds up should sort of stop being their customers. So that's kind of, you know, that's something that I think is different about GiveWell. It's not perfect. It's not as good as, like, perfectly measuring our outcomes and holding us accountable to those, but that just isn't really realistic. And so that's where I think we're coming from and what we're trying to bring about. And I think that also relates to some other questions people ask about GiveWell. We have done things in the past where we've kind of chosen to go the route of putting out information that is not necessarily the most favorable to our mission in a short-term sense. And that includes writing about the struggles of Village Reach. That includes admitting a lot of the limitations of the evidence around bed nets and deworming and cash transfers. But that's kind of us, you know, eating that short-term cost because we're making a long-term bet on this brand of having our arguments be the best, most accurate things we can say in support of what we believe.
So we wanted to know about and understand more about the relationship between Good Ventures and GiveWell and GiveWell's upcoming move to the Bay Area. Very brief, and again, you know, we've written a lot about this. I mean, Good Ventures is a major donor who is a major donor to charities, and you know, I think their giving will grow over time. And you know, it's a group whose values about transparency and about cause agnosticism, which is something we've talked about in the past, are values that they share with us. And so, a lot of ways, you know, Good Ventures is somewhat like the perfect partner donor for GiveWell. And so, you know, we do work very closely with them in our research. When our interests overlap, which they often do, we work together. When they don't overlap, we go our separate ways. And, you know, I think that, you know, both Good Ventures and GiveWell are providing a lot of value to each other. GiveWell to Good Ventures in that we're, providing a lot of resources to do research that Good Ventures would otherwise not have, and then, you know, Good Ventures to GiveWell, you know, not only by, you know, directly funding our top charities, but also by, you know, creating the incentive for some organizations to speak with us who otherwise might not.
So as far as the move to the Bay Area goes, that's a combination of wanting to work more closely with Good Ventures and also wanting to test the idea that there's going to be a more receptive audience to GiveWell there than in New York. And, you know, I think we have some reasons to believe that'll be the case. It's certainly far from guaranteed, but certainly it feels like, you know, our network there is about as good as our network here right now, even though we've been here for 5 years. And so I think that's a risk worth taking for GiveWell, that the costs are actually, you know, not exorbitant. I mean, we can move back if it doesn't work out, but this seems like something that has very high potential benefits. So that is part of the reason, and part of the reason is to be closer to Good Ventures so that we can work more closely with them, because they do, you know, at this time they have one full-time staffer, but we have enough in common in terms of the things we're trying to do that it's helpful to coordinate pretty closely, and that is, you know, only obviously in the areas where our missions overlap. That's only when we're trying to do the same thing.
So we had a question about some of our future causes. So Holden, I'll read it, but then why don't you take the answer? So the question was, you know, any hints about what the promising neglected causes are? You know, any thoughts about, you know, causes that focus on the far future? And, you know, also given that given that we're now going into these low probability of high impact projects, you know, how are we going to deal with regression to the mean in the future, given the weaker evidence base for those projects?
Sure. Just a couple examples of what, you know, causes that we have been looking into because we think they're promising for one reason or another. Certainly the category of global catastrophic risks, and is something that a lot of people have raised to us as something they think is promising. And we think there is kind of a sound argument here, which is that global catastrophic risks are things that could have just like such a huge cost to humanity. And this is, you know, an example would be climate change. Another example would be risk of being hit by an asteroid. And there are other areas, other things as well that one might think of that, you know, it's sort of it's hard to articulate who else besides a philanthropist has really got the incentives lined up to work on these things. And so it's kind of a natural fit for philanthropy. It's the kind of thing where even a small chance of having an impact could be enough to kind of make it worth it because the potential impact is so big. And there may be areas that are relatively neglected within this, but the last part is something that we're not sure of at all. And so certainly the dollars spent on these causes from our rough cut look smaller than the dollars spent on a lot of other causes, but we're not actually sure whether, you know, whether when we go looking out there for the biggest threats, large-scale threats, whether we're really going to see a lot of low-hanging fruit or whether we're going to see that there are appropriate agencies and people working on these things. And so that's a big question. Kind of the first global catastrophic risk we've been looking at, and this is a little different from the other one, is climate change. That's something we'll be writing about fairly soon. And that one is not one of the more neglected ones in philanthropy terms, but certainly is, you know, one of the ones that has more evidence out there regarding how serious it is. And so it was an interesting place for us to dive in and start looking around. Another cause that's pretty different, that's an example of the kind of thing we're looking at, is migration. There was a study that was kind of arguing that an intervention to help people migrate and kind of give them the liquidity and the risk protection they needed to migrate from rural to urban areas was very beneficial to them and actually led to them migrating again the next year without getting that same kind of support. And so this is an example of something that, you know, we think has a strong intuitive case, has one study, but this isn't something where we think it's time with that intervention to be looking for a charity that's rolling out some specific migration intervention. Rather, the thing we're wondering is whether this is an anti-poverty intervention that kind of just isn't getting any attention. And maybe there should be more study of it. Maybe there should be, you know, more discussion of it leading down the road to a stronger view on how promising it is. So that's a very different endeavor from kind of looking for a charity that will translate dollars directly into, like, vaccines delivered or something. As far as how we're going to deal with the fact that, you know, I do believe that when your evidence is weaker, that is a major issue. And I think that, you know, all else equal, something that has strong evidence behind it is a better bet than something that's kind of got a lot of guesswork. And so I don't have much to say about how we're going to handle that, except that we're just going to make our arguments about why the promisingness of an of a certain area is enough that it makes sense for us to be recommending things there, despite not having kind of proof that what worked before will work again. And I do think we'll be able to do so, because I think that one thing we believe is that we believe in investigating things very thoroughly and investigating them from a lot of angles. And so I think any recommendations we make in these broader causes, there will be a lot of conversations, a lot of conversation notes with people who know what they're talking about, and we'll be looking at a lot of different angles, and hopefully if we recommend something, we'll be able to make an argument that, hey, you know, this thing is worth trying, it makes a lot of sense, and there's no one else doing it, and we've got a good organization to do it, and so a recommendation can be made, despite the lack of sort of evidence that it worked before and it could work again. But time will tell. I mean, we don't know yet, and we'll see as time goes on how strong a case we're able to make.
Yeah, another
thing that's worth noting is that all the proven interventions that we talk about today, you know, those wouldn't exist without a lot of high-risk efforts that people have taken. And so, you know, we've got a lot of medical technologies that were developed through research that was, you know, at the time there was nothing proven about it. And so that's one thing that makes you think, you know, there's probably more to good-giving opportunities than just taking the things that people have already taken the risks to establish and just paying for them to reach the maximum people possible. It seems like there ought to be good opportunities on the other end as well, but that's not something I know. That's just something that I think is worth checking out.
Yeah, another cause that someone asked about is political advocacy for, you know, you could imagine something like improving or increased spending on aid or, you know, or other type of political lobbying. You know, again, that's the type of activity that certainly seems like it could be among the most impactful charitable activities. It's one that many philanthropists focus on. It's also challenging because the issues themselves are complicated and it's not always clear what side to be on. It's complicated to measure impact. So it's one that we hope to look into, but that is, you know, in the somewhat far future of GiveWell. So I think we've now covered the questions that have come in. If anyone has questions that they, you know, just wanted to discuss directly, we're happy to stick on the line for a while and do that. So in order to do that, you just have to hit *6 on your phone, then follow the instructions. I think you then have to hit 1, and then you'll be in the queue and you'll have a chance to discuss. So we'll give people a couple minutes to see if anyone wants to do that. You know, as always, feel free to drop off the line when you want. If you've had enough, we are planning to post the recording of this call on our website, so you'll have a chance to hear it later.
And my question is, it seems like you've done a lot of work, like thinking about, like, if you were wrong about, like, these charities being the most effective, like, what would that look like? Like, you did a full audit of AMF, and I'm sure you do a lot of thinking, like also in your spare time, what's the scenario that makes our analysis wrong?
Yep.
I'm curious, just, like, 5 years down the road, if you could give me, like, a guess of how likely it is that you think, like, obviously it's a good gamble, but how likely it is 5 years down the road you'll be like, yep, we nailed that one. That was definitely the right decision to make given what we know at the time, and how likely it is that it would be like, well, like, it was a pretty good recommendation, it was a very good gamble, we did some good, but, like, there are probably other ways we could have gone there. I'm not sure if that question makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I mean, I think certainly we do spend a lot of time thinking about what it would look like if we were wrong, and we still see ourselves as new to giving. And I don't look back and sort of think, you know, that the charities we recommended early on were necessarily worked out great. I think they were kind of good bets, as you say. So as far as where we stand on today's top charities, you know, I think on this pure question of how likely are we to look back and say this roughly did as much good as we were thinking it would do, I think there's a pretty steep difference, and I'm going to speak for myself and let others chime in if they disagree. I think a pretty steep difference between number one and between the others. I think AMF is doing one of the most proven interventions, and we've seen it carry out this intervention, and we have a rough sense of what's going on. Even there are definitely concerns. I mean, there's questions about whether AMF is going to find partners that can execute the way that AMF needs them to execute. And, you know, in 2012, it didn't find those partners at the rate that we would have wanted and didn't find enough to get the money out the door. So there's that kind of question. There are these questions about mednets that are lingering. I mean, there's these questions of whether people use them. I think the answer is yes. There's these questions about insecticide resistance. I think the answer is that mednets are still working. But certainly, I think these could turn out to be wrong. And so, you know, I think that, I don't know, I think it would take me more thought to put out a percentage I'd feel good about, and then I'll probably put in that thought. But, you know, I would say that AMF, I think there's a pretty high chance that we'll look back and feel like it did what we hoped it would do, but a high chance, not overwhelming. I think with the other two, there's a lot more question marks, and I think they're kind of calculated risks. So with GiveDirectly, it's a newer organization, and part of the reason that we're recommending it is this kind of a calculated risk. It's that we see the upside. And so I think there's actually a very substantial chance that, you know, in the next few years, they'll discover that there's something kind of unexpected about the way they're doing their program that calls for changes. And so the money spent on transfers in the first couple of years was not what we hoped it would be. And I think with SCI, I think they're, you know, in addition to the issues we've raised with deworming, I mean, I think I wouldn't be surprised if a replication of the study didn't find the same results. I think there's also this issue of the organization where we haven't always felt totally clear on what the money's doing and on, you know, on exactly what's going on. And so I wouldn't, you know, I think there's some risk that we look back and say, well, this money wasn't spent in the way we kind of imagined it being spent, and the activities carried out were not exactly what we imagined being carried out. So, you know, the short answer is I think there are decent chances with all our top charities that this is not something where I'm saying, yeah, we got this. And that's why we value learning so much. And that's why a major weight in how we're ranking these charities and the fact that we're recommending them is about, you know, if we move money to these charities, we think we will learn more and we think we will get better at giving in the future. And we do sort of think that most of the impact of our recommended giving, you know, the sort of direct tactical impact could be in the future, but the impact of giving now is that we learn and that we get better at it. So that's a major factor in how we're thinking about all this stuff. It's a major factor in how we rank stuff. And, you know, that is what it is. I think that, you know, AMF is definitely something we feel more confident about than the other two in terms of, like, looking back and thinking that it did what we thought it would. Ellie, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically how I would describe it too. I mean, I think if you're looking for the organization with the combination of, you know, the highest likelihood of having impact, you know, especially in the context of everything we know, I mean, I think AMS is a pretty good bet, you know, given, you know, the weight of the evidence behind the intervention and the organization's track record and you know, the other two have some more of the, you know, complications that, that Holden mentioned. You know, of course, that's worth putting all that in the context of you know, these are, you know, I still think, you know, they are great organizations working on, you know, great interventions, is certainly relative to the, you know, all of the different charitable programs out there.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Well, here's a question, which is quite, that someone emailed in, which is quite difficult to answer, which is, what is the ratio of your perceived impact for AMF versus Partners in Health?
The ratio of a perceived impact for AMF versus Partners in Health. This is one of these times when I think that putting a number on it, especially an off-the-cuff number, is likely to create more confusion than information. I think it's easier to give a qualitative answer. That basically, you know, we just have a lot more questions about what the dollars are doing with Partners in Health, in addition to major concerns about whether the good accomplished per dollar is comparable to AMF. And so, you know, I feel strongly that AMF is a better bet for an individual donor giving than Partners in Health. I feel strongly that bed nets are probably accomplishing more good per dollar, given the information we have. And I feel strongly that I would feel much more confident in the idea that my dollars were doing something along the lines of what I imagine them to be doing if giving to AMF. But, you know, to come up with a ratio, I mean, I think giving to either one does some good. And I think that giving to either one very likely does not do exactly the kind of good that we calculated and imagined. So I think that's probably where I'd let that end, unless either one of you wants to try and give some more context there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just want to say that, you know, something, you know, the hope, the ideal, you know, the attempt of providing kind of a dollar per impact type of quantification of what charities do, is certainly something that, you know, we would like to do. It's something that we, you know, I would say intended to do as we began GiveWell. And it's just something where over the years, as we've actually tried to deal with the figures, you know, we've just struggled to come up with a way to do that in a way that actually seems to clarify things more than it obscures them. And so, you know, this question of, well, you know, how would you rank the, you know, what ratio would you use for AMF versus PIH, or similarly, you know, are any of our top charities versus other organizations, you know, that we feel good about? I mean, whether it's something like Doctors Without Borders, which we have a generally positive view on, or many other organizations, it just becomes so difficult. And, you know, the way that we've handled that is to say, you know, there are a set of organizations that, you know, everything we know about them, from the strength of the evidence to their need for additional dollars, to the strength of the organization, which, you know, includes their commitment to transparency and sharing information, you know, as well as other things that we've written about, you know, that then leads us to organizations that we're going to really strongly recommend give our money to, recommend donors give money to. And then for the rest, we, you know, we just don't really feel like we're able to give a number that ends up being helpful.
Yeah. So one kind of tangential point on cost effectiveness analysis in general is that I do want to note that, you know, I feel like we've said a lot of things on this call about how the limitations of cost effectiveness analysis, and shied away from giving numbers on the basis that may create more confusion than clarification. You know, I want to put in context that I do think that we have possibly put more effort into getting the right cost effectiveness figures, like the cost per life saved, than anyone else in the world. We've seen the kind of efforts put together by, you know, Disease Control Priorities Report, and we've seen the efforts put together by others. And, you know, I think there's an argument that we have worked harder at getting this done than anyone else. And so it's something that we really want to do, and it is something that we definitely, you know, conceptually, cost effectiveness is what we want. We want the maximum good accomplished per dollar. And in terms of how we spend our time, we try to get it right, and that's not just because of the numbers. It's also because trying to get it right helps clarify our thought process. It helps make sure we're asking all the right questions. And, you know, even after all the struggles, I think this is very worthwhile. I think that cost effectiveness analysis has actually been a really good use of time. It's helped us think about these issues better. It's helped us make sure that we've thought about the issues we need to be thinking about. And so, in the scheme of things, I think we're very pro cost effectiveness analysis. But it is through that experience, and it is through being up close with it and doing so much with it, that we have recognized its limitations and have come to feel that a lot of times putting a number out there can create more problems than it solves.
Okay. Well, it seems as if we've covered all the questions. We really appreciate everyone's joining this call tonight and asking us questions. I mean, one of the things we work very hard to do is to share our research and make it public, and engagement from, people like you who want to spend an evening on us with the phone is something that we really value and appreciate. If you have additional questions that you didn't get a chance to ask or didn't think of, or you want to review our materials and send in more, we're really always, we really appreciate getting questions from our audience, and talking about them over the phone or answering them over email or in blog comments or wherever. So please do not hesitate to send those in. We would really appreciate it. Well, thank you all for joining us tonight, and have a really great night.